interrupting the current neo-Ukronial, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism debris behind a woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 635. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind a woodshed. You take those miscreants right back there and you teach them what's what. Being free is being free of any oppression, actually. Well, we don't seem to believe that anymore. We seem to believe we have civil rights and that it's quite fine for the government to extend those equally to everyone. And we didn't look at the fine print that said those civil rights included extortions of every kind and no other. And you can read that right there at 42 U.S.C. 1981, if you would, please, and get an eyeball on what this place is about to start with. And you'll see very interesting statements in that equal rights under law provision of the United States Municipal Code. So understand that as well when you're claiming those so-called civil rights. But maybe the data you pay for is yours and free of being thieved for the moment. Google was hit with a $314 million verdict over Android data use. California jury has ordered Google to pay $314 million after finding it illegally used Android user cellular data without their knowledge. Listen to that part, because that's what I think the little hang-up will be in the near future when I said for the moment. The class action suit claimed Google sent data to its servers even when users weren't on Wi-Fi, using paid mobile data to boost its ad targeting and mapping services. Google plans to appeal, saying the users agreed to the transfers and that they are essential for device performance. Filed in 2019, the case covers California users. A federal case for all U.S. Android users is set for trial in 2026. So, there you have it. Google is using your data bandwidth to make its profit everywhere. And that data, they claim, is essential for device performance. I.e., using your device you bought and paid for, and the data you buy and pay for, and also diminishing that data to you that you buy and pay for to track you and serve you up, the ads and whatnot, to the immense profit of Google, is what is essential to these phones relative to these Androids, and not much different about the iOS. As I think about that, how is Google not one big criminal botnet then? Google claims that you agree, but is that really true? I mean, how many people really agree with that? You read the documentation and you find out exactly what you don't want, and you can opt out or you can go somewhere else. Is that really true that you agree? Did Google ever offer to pay you for the use of your phone and the data and the interoperability into their surveillance profiteering system in an arm's length transaction? I mean, if it were in a free and open transaction, I'd want to get in on the game and sell my phone and bandwidth and all the taxes for a profit, too. Not just a consent to carry water. And then would you actually enter into such a deal, knowing Google and no other company's motto says, don't be evil? Could you trust their contracts? Are you that fool of yourself to think that you could trust dealing with professional snakes in a system you do not understand nor control, except to not be in it? This case alone proves you cannot trust to deal with the wardens in the Siberian Gulag, though just as harmful and predatory, especially of the poor and dimwitted. It would be more honest that these companies foot the bill by offering a free phone, free use, free data, etc., that tracks and traces and records and monitors your every action or your inaction, actually, as we heard a couple of reports I've made, and they do that 24/7, right, Obama? But what am I saying? You think Google is the one and only doing this? These companies already get you to pay for it all, everything, even your carriers. They get you to do it to yourselves with every phone you buy and every other internet battlefield of things interoperable of the entire interwebs that you purchase with no way to change the agreement. Now, with extra tariff price increases. You think Google is the only one doing this? Or the only one to get caught? Well, the news tells us it's not the only one to get caught. And in large part, people generally agree to being enslaved by commerce and paying for it. Anyone with a driver's license or any other license for that matter knows that. And if you don't know that, it's a blinking neon sign. You are likely a programmed consumer. Now, AI error-prone enhanced, living in an occupied territory. Not much different than a fish that doesn't consider its breathing until it's yanked from the water, simultaneously asking, is that wet I feel? Yeah, programmed consumers are kind of like that, don't you know? And then gasping for air, you hope the leader that lured you to take the bait doesn't club you in the head to feast upon the rest of your monetized carcass. Or carquois, for my old French-speaking listeners, a human living or dead, or undead, as the corpus legally be. Found that very fascinating, the word carcass. Go read it. Even the petition for habeas corpus demands the body and asks, they have the carcass, why? From the fissures of all that is humanistic, we the multitude, human monsters of the sea, carquois to be harvested. How do you like that internet now? Another type of injunction upon our lives. SCOTUS gives Trump big win on national injunction. And I have to caution us on who they're giving the big win to. This is actually government that they're giving it. Trump happens to be in the place right now and pressing some of these issues. But listen very carefully on what the limit is and what it might cause in us. 6-3 ruling limits power of lower court judges to halt birthright citizenship restrictions nationally. One of the most highly anticipated rulings of this term Supreme Court docket has gone President Trump's way. In a 6-3 decision, the court severely limited the power of federal judges to impose national injunctions against presidential policies. The case stems from Trump's push to rescind birthright citizenship. The idea that anyone born in the United States is entitled to citizenship. But this particular ruling is a more narrow one, focused on the power of the federal judges rather than the citizenship policy. Still, it's a major victory for Trump, and it's, quote, may dramatically reshape how citizenship is granted in the United States, even temporarily. Several lawsuits have emerged challenging Trump's decision to end birthright citizenship, and multiple federal judges have ruled against the president and imposed nationwide injunctions against the policy. The Justice Department argued the judges exceeded their authority, and the Supreme Court agreed. Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote the majority opinion, quote, when a court concludes that the executive branch has acted unlawfully, the answer is not for the court to exceed its power to, it reads. The decision also stipulates that Trump's executive order, quote, shall not take effect until 30 days after the date of this opinion. Now, I found that pretty interesting. Why the delay? But there is one. I didn't look any deeper. Maybe some of you know. Maybe you don't. But this is a very interesting delay on something that should be an executive response that had power where the judges didn't. So my assumption here in the due process side of things is there's a window of opportunity for someone to make a petition to alter that potentially. And that bar will be very high, but they still have 30 days to do that. It's possible the Supreme Court could decide on the larger question of birthright citizenship in its next term. Justice Sotomayor, Elaine Kagan, and Kachanga Brown Jackson dissented. Per the Washington Post, Sotomayor wrote a scathing dissent. Quote, no right is safe in the new legal regime the court creates. Today, the threat is to the birthright citizenship. Tomorrow, a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people or certain faiths from gathering to worship. The majority holds that absent cumbersome class action litigation, courts cannot completely enjoin even such plainly unlawful policies unless doing so is necessary to afford the formal parties complete relief. That holding renders a constitutional guarantees meaningful in a name only for any individuals who are not parties to the lawsuit. Because I will not be complicit in so grave an attack on our system of law, I dissent. Isn't this really saying that no federal district court can make a blanket nationwide decisions that these cases are to proceed case by case, in particular to the parties to the case? That seems to be relative to this question where that we're going. And this is really not a question either. However, it's been made one now. And if this is a new legal regime, as she points out, do we want any clear violation of law to others similarly situated to not protect them and require that they hire an attorney for each and every case the government challenges district by district? You understand that's the battlefield now. The battle is it district by district, case by case, so the government continues to pound on our rights. And if you don't get it right, you lose. That's going to be how this thing is starting to come up if this is true, what she said. Maybe this is the more important case to watch on whether or not this is a stealthy attack trumping the constitutional, not statutory rights that we've had all this time as well. Another conservative uniparty failure, as I found them, we go through these tabs and all kinds of things going on, a lot of different places this week. Why it is conservative? It conserves and preserves. Supreme Court upholds key Obamacare provision. Affordable Care Act survives a conservative challenge. The Supreme Court preserved a key part of the Affordable Care Act's preventative health care coverage requirements on Friday, rejecting a challenge from Christian employers to the provision that affects some 150 million Americans. The 6-3 ruling comes in a lawsuit over how the government decides which health care medications and services must be fully covered by private insurance under former President Obama's signature law, often referred to as Obama's scare, as I deemed it. The plaintiff said that the process is unconstitutional because a volunteer board of medical experts tasked with recommending which services are covered is not Senate approved. President Trump's administration defended the mandate before the court, though Trump has been a critic of its predecessor's laws. The Justice Department said board members don't need Senate approval before they can be removed by Health and Human Services Secretary. The court agreed in a majority opinion written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The case came before the Supreme Court after an appeals court struck down some preventative care coverage requirements. The U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with Christian employers and Texas residents who argued they can't be forced to provide full insurance coverage for things like medication to prevent HIV and some cancer screening. So you pick up Texas residents includes insurance companies too. Not what you think is the residents, but these are commercial activities in the state with identities, legal entities. So also notice, at least from this reporting, this was not a First Amendment constitutional religious argument, but an establishment and lawful agency argument. The Justice Department said board members don't need Senate approval because they can be removed by the Health and Human Services Secretary. What seems odd to me is that the employers, like they did during the great Covey swindle, seem to also be saying they can practice medicine without a license, whether or not it took the Senate approval or not, as is the actual case here in this one. They were challenging preventative care here, contrary to the ostensible preventative care that they and the federal government unlawfully required during the great Covey swindle in the form of bioweapons fraudulently characterized as vaccine. Peculiar, don't you think? Or is nothing peculiar anymore since everything seems to be and is in some sort of lawfare condition or based in some constitutional inconvenience? So here I'm talking about the ability now the government may have to be opening up to attack us everywhere to keep pressing on whether or not we really have rights. And maybe we should start thinking about that. This is not a presumption. When I talk about the presumption of guilt being stolen from you all back in the PATRT Act, this is not a joke. This is where we're going on all these different issues coming forward. And speaking about constitutional inconvenience, that presumption of innocence, the Supreme Court doesn't much respect it or care for that. Supreme Court rules on age checks for porn sites. Supreme Court rules on age checks for porn sites and green lights age verification for those under 18 in 6-3 decision. But the hitch and the giddy up there is, how do they know you're under 18? So now we understand this is age verification or ID verification, digital ID verification, that has been allowed by the Supreme Court for doing a constitutionally protected activity without the presumption of innocence, that you are no longer a minor, ostensibly innocent. The Supreme Court on Friday upheld a Texas law aimed at blocking children under 18 from seeing online pornography. Nearly half of all states have passed similar age verification laws, as smartphones and other devices make it easier to access online porn, including hardcore obscene material. The 6-3 ruling, with the liberal judges dissenting, comes after an adult entertainment industry trade group called Free Speech Coalition challenged the Texas law. Just on that name, if we tied it into actual condition, I guess it doesn't exist, does it? There is no free speech to have a coalition. The group said the law puts an unfair free speech burden on adults by requiring them to submit personal information that could be vulnerable to hacking and tracking. It agreed, though, that children under 18 shouldn't be seeing porn. Texas argues that technology has improved significantly in the last 20 years, allowing online platforms to easily check users' ages with a quick picture. Those requirements are more like ID checks at brick-and-mortar adult stores that were upheld by the Supreme Court in the 1960s, the state says. Except, it isn't brick and mortar. It's the not quick but permanent biometric capturing of the site in the Siberian Gulag. You think it'll be limited to porn sites? You say don't mess with Texas? Well, Texas is messing with y'all, muchachos y muchachas. Siberian on the southern border and brand spanking new shiny wall to keep you all in as well. And before I could finish saying brand spanking new shiny wall to keep you in, South Dakota follows Texas with a broader online digital ID law. The Supreme Court endorsement of Texas age verification law for adult websites has paved the way for a surge, sounds like a sickness, a surge in similar online digital ID measures across the country. And notice, if you doubted a guy behind a woodshed, it is a digital ID implementation of the Siberian Gulag in the great state of South Dakota. That'll make America great again, by gum. South Dakota is the first to follow, as its new statute requiring age verification or estimation for sites distributing adult content takes effect today. And I found that interesting. For those of you in South Dakota, maybe look at that estimation. Maybe there's a way to move around this. They can estimate, they can create a test that can estimate whether or not you're young enough to not participate. However, the test is that you send them a note, you're going to sue them to prove that you're at the date, and you get them to court. And we're going to end this right now. You just take them to court and you prove your date there before a court of law. And then you won't be presumed no more, will you? Anyway, think about that. But anyway, estimation. Not age verification. I thought that was pretty interesting. Maybe there's a hole in that law, a loophole they call it, to get yourself back to being an adult. How do you like that? However, the South Dakota law is much broader, and this is what I was asking about. Do you think Texas is going to limit it to porn sites? Well, South Dakota didn't think so, and it's going to be now much broader and applies to a wider range of websites, not just those that have the large percentage of adult content. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley pointed to the Supreme Court's ruling as validation of the state's efforts to protect citizens through legislation aimed at shielding minors. And I've talked about this rights of child thing way long ago. This is an international imposition on the states they adopted. This is where it's all coming from. It started to move things through. And so this is where we're, I don't know, again, nobody wants to understand how this is working. And the adoptions of the foreignness is what has been bringing this country down. That's why it can't be made great again. As long as these types of foreign things are inside our gates, in our laws, and no one identifies them or can identify them. But you realize he says protect citizens, meaning you aren't presumed adult enough to protect yourself. So your presumption of innocence is destroyed until you can prove you're innocent of being a child needing protection. Do I have that about right? Have you ever seen how they flip this place on its head? This is how it starts to work. When I told you long ago, if the legislature start to make laws about this, we're going to be very in trouble about as trying to get them undone. You know, I kind of tie that together with that. Everyone thinks that the Second Amendment is sealed in stone. No, it can be changed, like any of this stuff. You get the right government bodies together, right people, the right politics together, and these things can be altered over time. But there's not going to be any administrative overburden on this case. This next case, SCOTUS issues ruling in religious rights case. Court says parents can pull their children from lessons including LGBTQ storybooks. And so there's always, to my mind, I read these in two different levels. When it talks of parents, which is the normal vernacular of the street that people think they are, mothers and fathers think they're parents, they're not, although that's the state treats you as a parent, a custodial agent of the child, which is a ward of the state. The rights of child then impose, this foreignness impose that the state can oversee all of the things with the wards, their wards of state, which is also parent patriens, patries type of logic, which it's also adults do not have power against. This is kind of getting us back over to the exigency discussion. I was telling you that even that does have a limitation if you know to go pull the trigger on that to protect yourself, which was the Greg Kobe swindle and the habeas corpus with the due process that was within the codes of the communicable disease law. So here's the court has come out and said, even as a custodial agent of the ward of the state, you do have direction that you can give directly, and the agents of the state are going to have to listen to what they have to give you notice as this thing comes out, and then they have to do what you've determined. As was expected after arguments in April, the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a group of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim parents in Maryland who sought to pull their children from lessons with LGBTQ themes. In a 6-3 ruling with the court's three liberal justices dissenting, the court overturned a lower court's decision not to require the Montgomery County School Board to allow opt-outs. The parents said that they weren't seeking to ban storybooks with LGBTQ characters, only to have their children excused from lessons that they said violated their religious beliefs. Today we hold that the parents have shown that they are entitled to a preliminary injunction, Justice Samuel Alito wrote for the majority. So here you have the burden upon the plaintiff to move that they were entitled to this privilege. It's not a right that you're bestowed. It's not, you don't have them, they're gave to you. Only when you can prevail in a court. The government burdens the religious exercise of parents when it requires them to submit their children to instruction that poses a very real threat of undermining the religious beliefs and practices that the parents wish to instill. So those of you that are listening and pay attention, there's your quote. You go to these cases, you can read the quotes, the basis for what they're deciding, and then frame your discussion, your challenge, your request to have those rights gave to you in the same way and have the facts to back that up. So this was an interesting case to my mind that it's now the custodians of the wards of the state do have a power relative to a religious belief. But I ask, where's the court? What were the courts here during the Great Kobe Swindle when parishioners were blocked from worship services and the local government failed to non-fraudulently demonstrate an infectious agent being carried by the principal, the subject of the infection. When was this, this law applied there? The court ruled that while the litigation continues, the school board, Maryland's largest, must notify parents when storybooks with LGBTQ characters or themes will be used and must allow them to have their children excused. So there you go. The thing Trump tries to deny to people, due process, but recognizes the need for notice, giving an opportunity to respond, is recognized again in this case. Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissent, quoted from a 1987 opinion describing public schools as, quote, at once the symbol of our democracy and the most pervasive means of promoting our common destiny. She argued that the idea will become a mere memory if children must be insulated from exposure to ideas and concepts that may conflict with their parents' religious beliefs. But maybe it's not the content, but the time the content is presented. Or so that it doesn't constitute child abuse or grooming functions, maybe. The school board initially allowed opt-outs, but later withdrew the policy, saying it had become disruptive. Disruptive. Your rights to decide is disruptive, see? It is noted that three Supreme Court justices live in the county, but they don't send their children to public schools. So maybe that's a warning to y'all. Don't send your kids, your little goats, to public school, even if called children. Otherwise known being the ward of the state. What's the alternative that may or may not be recognized? Some people who have pushed this have gotten this point recognized, is that you're a mother and you're a father. You're not a legal entity called the custodial agent of the ward of the state, the parent. And so look and study that very carefully if you go down that trail. It's out there. You might find some people that have done it. It's very difficult. Again, the state doesn't want to let go of their property. You have to be able to identify that you're not. The more ties you can cut before you do that, the better. However, that's we get even as parents, you get to have a say now. At least until the end of this case, because it's still going on, isn't it? And here's just a report of a note to a Forest Service, the land producers out there. Don't get these many, don't report on these as much as I used to, but there hasn't been much to report on actually. We have the first indication that we're coming back again, and we have the ability to, the White House, to reverse rule that protects 59 million acres. The roadless rule blocked logging on national forest lands. Now, again, national forest lands are different than BLM lands, and so you be careful on applying these across the board, but these roadless rules are killing us as producers, all the producers. And again, this is just a put in the Clinton era that was about environmentalism and didn't look at what the obligation of the government was to maintain the use of land, not the non-use, the conservation of land, which is essentially a war crime because it interferes with production. It interferes with raw materials production for the society. And I've talked about all this in the past. I won't go through this again. But we have now, like the Trump one, we had a lifting and a cessation of hostilities of the federal government against producers. They didn't lift the roadless rule, but I'm talking at that time mostly for the miners and this and that. And then Jefferson Mining District was involved. They relaxed that imposition on us. And then Biden came back, and he came back with a vengeance, even worse. And now we have another breathing area. So those of you that are understanding about this, it's time to kind of roll up your sleeves and get, you got like 3.5 years before it might change. If they can get this thing thrown off beyond Trump, the White House, and get it from the executive and move this into the legislation again and remove it, then we might have a chance to make at least a productive section of America great again. Because it's not about the government at that point. It's strictly about the people that go to work. Those of us that have to go to work, the miners, the ranchers, the farmers, the people that use the lands, not to watch them turn to smoke and dust and ash. The Trump administration plans to rescind a nearly quarter century old rule that blocked logging on national forest lands. Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins announced on Monday the roadless rule, adopted in the last days of Bill Clinton's presidency of 2001, has long chafed Republican lawmakers, especially in the West, where national forests sprawl across vast mountainous terrain and the logging industry has waned. The rule impeded road construction and responsible timber production that would have helped reduce the risk of major wildfires, Rawlins said at the annual meeting of the Western Governors Association. And remember, if those of you that listened to me, we were talking all about that, exactly what we did locally to get one commissioner in one county to be recognized by Trump during Trump 1. Remember that? She was invited back to the White House and did a little speech. Didn't have much time, but did a little speech that my friend wrote for her in the studies that we had done. I was advancing to them, and they were working out to try and get done. And so we're pretty close to this one. The cutting of the trees, the sustained yield harvest, not sustainable harvest, but sustained yield harvest, was what the law required in the BLM side, which is also required by yielding in 1905, the yield derived from national forest lands. That has been completely obliterated and eliminated by the government generally. And we found out that when they did that and doing the analysis with the watershed analysis, that was what helped fuel these major wildfires. And they shifted from fire suppression to fire management. They manage these fires to burn and burn and burn and burn, or they let the forest grow to where they can't put them out. It looks like they're letting them go until they burn and burn and burn. It's still the same end. Mother Nature puts them out then. But everybody, big sucking sound, going to pay for all this firefighting apparatus. If you remember correctly about the times back when, that I was talking about, the Western Governors Association is a closet cancer that promotes sustainable things in this article. It's like they don't even know they're dealing with Dracula with this Governors Association. We had to counter them because they represent the governors, which are clueless to the green agenda against their own nature good, unless they are part of it. If the governor is in a particular state, isn't already that green, they then attack and convince the other governors that might have a little bit of savvy but don't have the real time to think about it. And that's a lot of the work. The attorney, the torners, give advice that's improper to the law and valid practice and production. And that was a major fight with inside the county to overcome what the attorneys were saying, produce what the law was, produce its logic, produce what it was supposed to do, produce the obligations, and defeat the attorneys from giving wrong advice, which was to advance the green agenda. So this is a multifaceted attack, a fight that we're doing. But so remember, too, again, these attorneys, all their bar members, attorneys, are giving this advice. The attorneys of which have not denounced the Bar Association's embrace of the promotion of sustainable development, as stated in their corrupted organization's House Delegate Resolutions, which I've read behind the woodshed a number of times. So we go back to the article here to point some of this out. You'll see it built in when I talk about the Governor Association. The language is a cancer. It's this leech that sits in there waiting for the future to start really taking down and growing quicker and quicker once, let's say, this administration goes away. This move opens a new era of consistency and sustainability for our national forest, Rawlins says. Scientists say that worsening wildfires are driven by a combination of climate change that warms and dries out forests, less logging, and decades of fire suppression that have allowed fuels to build up. So when you take away the harvest, and now they blame suppression, the quick extinguishment of a fire, now it becomes suppression, but it now becomes a culprit. But it's all backed around this so-called climate change, which is not about the weather. And when you get to good representatives of the people to understand that, as we found in a few, mostly one commissioner, then they are able to move this thing around and explain it better, and the laws come back around to where they're functioning to serve the people. When you're managing fire, you also have health issues because the smoke lingers all summer as another fallback. But I don't want to get into all that. I'm just pointing out that they're lifting this up so that there may be some more harvesting going on, and there's a lot of funds and money going through towns that starts to happen, even though, and I'm hoping it hasn't decimated that logging industry to where the mills are shut down so bad that they can't handle what might be coming through. again, Mother Nature is fantastic in growing stuff. Okay, it just blows me away how fast things grow, even though we look at it and it takes a long time. There's vast amount of land that are growing a lot of stuff, small all the time. It's always growing. And so there it is in that statement of the sustainability and the climate change, the continuing connection to sustainable development through that climate change, for sure. Which, again, is not about the weather. And if you don't know that, you don't understand how to approach the problem at all. You start arguing, oh, it can't happen, this and that. No, it's not about the weather. So stop arguing weather things. Now, you've heard me discuss the loss of logging and consequent growing disasters due to wildfires. And I referenced that wildfire map again today at JeffersonMiningDistrict.com to show how bad the national forests are related and managed through the Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon side that exacerbate the fires. You'll see the class 3, which is never, ever supposed to be had in a forest area, ever, because it can't. Those are catastrophe fires. Those are areas when a fire goes into them, you have a catastrophe. It cannot be put out until Mother Nature does. And in places where the water is not very high, like on the eastern side of Oregon, the water levels, the rains don't come in very high, it's dry, it's simply a disaster. It's not ever supposed to be managed. The forest, it's not a forest, then. It's just a tinderbox waiting to be struck with a match. So these adverse effects also that come through the wildfires and destroys the water and the air and the wildlife, far worse than the production from the land in most cases, than the environmentalists will let on they cause through their non-use or waste advocacy. And unless there was an overthrow of that governor's association management to bring it around to the law, our efforts then may have had an effect on this balancing measure to keep the Western Governors Association relevant and plausibly influential during the Trump administration. These are the things that we tried to get Trump to do during Trump won, this thing that they're doing right now, finally. But he didn't want to acknowledge us, JMD, Jefferson Mining District, despite acknowledging the commissioner that I was helping through my friend to get her into office. And then she became a really great county commissioner. Great person to have in office. I wish all the county commissioners were like her. And so much so, she was recognized all the way from Washington on being able to turn around forests and not have the fires that we had. And it was all basically just understanding the National Wildfire Policy Act that I discussed with you all long ago and read it to you and showed you right where it was. The local county government has the power, and they don't really know that. They don't understand how they can stop all this nonsense that was going on. So we tried to do that. We got it all out. They got it recognized. We were moving everything to fire suppression and then moving to sustained yield harvest. So the roadless issue comes up now and allows this harvesting again. And I hope they kick into it fast because they'll be able to get our production back up. Again, the productive sector of America becomes great again because it can produce. It can do what it does. The people that do that do that. So this report should not have described the effect as opening a new era of consistency and sustainability for our national forests. It shouldn't be a new era, but a fulfillment of the best productive use of the public domain, the lawful purpose of the highest use of the land, not non-use, which is considered waste. Again, as I've mentioned over and routinely, when this comes up, this subject matter comes up, and the interference of these raw materials production is a war crime. And I referenced that a long time ago. My first reference was talking about Israel going into Palestine and stealing just the gravel. You think, oh, just taking rocks. No, that's a raw material, a needed raw material. That's a war crime to steal from another country that way and other people that way. And it's supposed to be stopped, but you see how far it's gone. When you didn't stop that, look how they get licensed. They keep getting worse and worse and worse. They're doing that here in the United States. In that regard, it would have been more accurately described in this report as restoring existing law requiring sustained yield harvest and other valuable production and proper watershed management for wildfire suppression. And remember, I talked to you about that. One of my other colleagues is a ecological scientist who studies watersheds, have had studies about watersheds and studied watersheds for science, doing the science part. And there's a way to grow a watershed. And you keep it at a class 1 where it's self-extinguishing. It saves and preserves water. It's able to use the snow, if there's any snow, properly. It just doesn't stick up in the trees and it re-evaporates. So there's all kinds of interesting things that can be done in a watershed to properly manage it, to be able to, that you can suppress a fire if you have one of those. Otherwise, the forest grows in a self-extinguishing manner. The roadless rule has affected 30% of the national forest lands nationwide and other 59 million acres, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the agency over the Forest Service. So there's another thing to deal with them. The state roadless area rules in Idaho and Colorado supersede the boundaries of the 2001 roadless rule, according to USDA, meaning not all national forests would be affected by a rescission. Understand the power there, and then go look and see whether they did it right or wrong, and you see the power is in the state. It is in the state. It depends on how they wield it. Again, it's a disposal for use. It's an enabling act power in the state to do what they need to do in order to do that. If you have people that don't understand that, you can actually make a bad rule. But if it doesn't affect them, I'm assuming, and maybe wrongfully so check this out, that they were able to jump in and they were able to protect a lot of that. We'd have to go back and see that if you're interested. Because again, there's the time to jump in on this if you're so inclined to do that. And so the roadless rule now goes before, it's not finished to get done. It has to go through the formal notice period. Even now Trump can suggest it, but now it goes through the notice period because it's agency, it's administrative. So this is following the administrative procedures that are required. Again, those of you that are interested, make your comment to the federal. Go look to the Federal Registry notice for it. And I found out this can work. JMD was able to stop a number of creeks from being withdrawn from mining a number of years ago by showing the agency's information supporting closure was fraudulent. Being one of the few supporting production governments to, probably the only one, to comment. We weren't able to stop all of them, but we did stop some of them. And part of that is, again, we were the sole one doing the observations with any kind of knowledge about it. And we can only cover so much. In fact, because the agency was going to take out a river that it was on our creek that where my mining claim is, that's one of the things we were able to show was a fraud. They said that there was salmon going up the river, and it couldn't have been because we had a rock slide that had been there for 25 or so years that no fish could pass 2 miles down. And so we were able to show that they were just circling maps and just declaring them to be salmon streams. And again, this is the problem of having eyeballs out in the forest. If you're not don't have producers out in the forest looking, you don't have the evidence that you can bring to an official that may have to make a decision. And so, if you will, those of you that are producers, get involved, get into that. You're logging people. Keep this running. Show how it's a violation, and then move further to get the legislation removed. Get rid of that. But relative to the miners getting in and the roadless rule and getting us in, we didn't have too much of a problem in one regard, but it becomes an environmental problem that the agency, the environmentalists, jump all over, and so that becomes a little more battle. But maybe if American miners can begin to contribute to science again as well, getting in there, if the government would stop violating the land disposal laws, as we can read here, what may be out there for us, Russian miners find 40-million-year-old cockroach. The fossilized insect was discovered in a piece of amber in Kaliningrad region. So politicians have existed for near ever, it seems. A fossilized cockroach, estimated to be 35 to 40 million years old, has been discovered in a piece of amber in Russia's Kaliningrad region. The specimen was found during manual sorting of Kaliningrad Amber Combine, a facility operated by the technology giant Rostec, the company announced on Thursday. The insect is encased in 41 to 21 millimeter piece of amber weighing 7 grams. Rostec noted that the cockroach is preserved near the surface of the amber, allowing for detailed observation of its wings, legs, and head. Anna Dugina, a gemologist at the Kaliningrad Amber Combine, said that the find is the largest cockroach-like specimen discovered by the facility in the past 5 years. She estimated its age at no less than 35 to 40 million years. Quote, the cockroach was covered in resin in an exceptionally fortunate way, she added. It is located very close to the surface of the amber, but still far enough away from the edge. This made it possible to spot the inclusions during sorting and later grind and polish the surface without damaging it. The scientists explained that although the insect differs from the cockroaches found today, similar species still live in the tropical areas and in Washington, D.C. Wait, tropical insects around 53 degrees and 63 degrees north latitude? You mean global warming was not detrimental to the Baltic Sea area? And likely Siberia being at 52 degrees and 72 degrees north latitude? Is that why Greenland is named green and not white or gray land? The Kaliningrad Amber Combine is the only enterprise globally that mines amber on an industrial scale, a facility that developed unique extraction methods to preserve the integrity of amber pieces, especially those containing inclusions of flora and fauna. The discovery adds the collection of the Kaliningrad Regional Amber Museum, which houses over 14,000 individual pieces, including more than 3,000 amber inclusions. Who'd have thunk it? Global warming. How cool is that? Right, Greta? Trump gets pinned again by the law he's been unjustly wrestling with. Trump suffers major blow in attempt to overhaul U.S. elections. Federal judge just ruled against Trump's executive order changing voting requirements in this country. We keep putting this into our minds, folks. There's a way this place was wired. It's supposed to follow a certain pattern. It's supposed to have limits. It's supposed to have the constraints. It's supposed to have those equal partitions in the government that have supposed equal power. And you're not supposed to jump across and overreach and grab the stuff that's not on your plate. This is my main problem with Trump at this point. That's what he does. And the courts are there, gladly, I guess, to stop it. And to me, it doesn't matter in some regard, because these are areas that I have long since walked away for. But we can see there's a function that's still there. It's not there. And these are the things I say behind the woodshed, that you can look to see whether or not you, not necessarily for this, but we can see evidence of due process does exist. And if you're not getting it, you can demand it. The more you're not getting it, the more corrupt of a system you're in. And the bigger flag you fly that says you're not able to do that. And likely, all these same types of discussions that are had that he gets beat up on, you're going to have a better chance to survive that due process challenge. Again, back to the great COVID swindle, the habeas corpus is a due process challenge. You're just coming in and saying you didn't have authority. You didn't provide the rules the way you didn't do the law the way it was supposed to do by the rules. And you just gathered me up and said I was supposed to be locked down. No, that's not supposed to be the way it works. That's a due process violation. So that's how it's reverse said in the habeas corpus. You have the body. Why? You have that carcass. You don't have to have it live or dead. You just have the carcass. Because we now know we all have legal entities that precede us, it seems. You have the carcass. Why? What's your lawful reason for why? And they have to ask the guy or gal's got you. So, due process, right here as well. You can't overreach. You can't just make up stuff. It's not a law that he can't, he's got to have a law to execute. The federal judge has just ruled against Trump's executive order changing voting requirements in this country. A federal judge blocking portions of Trump's administrative order, Friday, that would have required voters to show proof of citizenship at the voting booth. In a 44-page memorandum, U.S. District Judge Denise Casper ordered that adding layers of difficulty to the voting process would only harm eligible voters by adding significant barriers before they can cast their ballots. Let me offer just a little observation. Eligible voters, that's the thing that's not been defined that everybody believes they know what it is, that status. That, I think, is the problem. It's not really what people think. Casper further noted that Donald Trump order was an executive overreach and that the authority to set new election requirements rests with Congress. In other words, rests with the legislative branch making the law from which an executive branch official or agency will use the rules to implement what Congress determines needs to happen. There is no dispute, nor could there be, the United States citizenship is required to vote in a federal elections, and that federal voter registration forms require attestation of citizenship, Casper wrote. The issue here is whether the president can require documentary proof of citizenship where the authority for election requirements is in the hands of Congress. Its statute, acts do not require it, and the statutorily created Elections Assistance Commission is required to go through a notice and comment period and consult with the states before implementing any changes to the federal forms for voter registration. So just in the tab before this, talking about this due process that's required, Trump is negating where he agreed to put it in the agency into rules for the roadless rule to be gone through the administrative process. He's not agreeing that due process is applicable to here. And the court's saying, no, it is. You can't do that kind of a rule change from your desk. One of the five provisions of the executive order blocked by Casper mandated that the Elections Assistance Commission collect a record information and record information, provided documentary proof of citizenship in the National Voter Registration Form. Casper's ruling also intervened in a White House decree that ordered the Secretary of Defense to update the absentee application for overseas voters or Americans in military, which under Trump's direction would have required such voters to provide proof of citizenship as well as proof of eligibility to vote in their respective states. Quote, neither the Constitution nor any statute grants the President the authority to enact such an order, the judge wrote. So I suppose we wait to hear what the law really is going to be from the Supreme Court, if different. If the law so-called is this fickle, how are you given adequate notice by its publication as to whether it's truly valid against anyone? Is the legal fiction of all time? And another ongoing fiction, if and you didn't think my characterization of the Donald WWE Manhattan Mauler Trump presidency was for entertainment purposes only. Trump, for 250th birthday, a UFC fight at the White House. It will be part of the America 250 celebration, he says. At an American 250 kickoff event in Iowa Thursday night, President Trump declared that, quote, the golden age of America is upon us, and that this incredible national resurgence is happening just in time for one of the biggest events in the history of our country. Exactly. You get that. Exactly 1 year from tomorrow, we will celebrate the 250th anniversary of America's founding with a birthday party, the likes of which you have never seen before. He wasn't exaggerating, at least in one respect. As part of the celebration of Americans' 250th birthday, an ultimate fighting championship fight will be held at the White House. Quote, I think we're going to have a UFC fight, Trump said. Does anybody watch UFC? He replied. We're going to have a UFC fight, I think of this, on the grounds of the White House. We're going to have a UFC fight, championship fight, full fight, like 25,000 people. And we're going to do this as a part of 250 also, Trump said. We're going to have some incredible events, some professional events, some amateur events, but the UFC fight's going to be a big deal too. Making America great again, one UFC extravaganza at a time. Just a big, entertaining party. Party on, dudes and dudettes. And as I've observed, the purported efficiency drive was running cover for reorganization of the criminal syndicate, foreign and domestic, it turns out. Trump repurposes USAID to technocrats and uses ceasefire to legalize full Zionist U.S. takeover of Palestine. Beware of the mainstream alternative media profiting off hopium, says the U.S. empire is finished thanks to Trump as he enacts a W. Bush-era foreign policy in the Middle East and abroad. But this lead by Fiorella Isabel misses another point relevant to what Trump is doing to America that she sees as a question, characterizing it as a Gestapo-sounding condition. Well, maybe it could be characterized by lots of things, but it's different than any singular characterization that she's doing relative to this story. But there's another theme working in this writing that she has. And I've explained this in previous episodes. If she does acknowledge the perception of the existence of a thing just inside the geopolitical fog, which I have explained is more than a vague aberration, but it's a solid reality, the hastening of technocracy such as it is explained, but more a method of subjugation, global apartheid, already evidenced in Trump's prior deceptive acts relative to the Middle East, now being implemented in America. I've been making these correlations around the globe with different instances over there, showing you they are happening here. They've been happening, actually. So take note of this insightful article here, was written in February of 2025, revisiting the current affairs over there that I've been explaining for years is happening over here, Trump's cheerleaders to the contrary notwithstanding. For instance, the Musk-Trump kerfuffle playing both ends against the middle. The Middle East? No, Middle America. She begins writing, I must have fallen down Alice's tunnel, sadly sans psychedelics, because I've been sent back to 2003 during the war in Iraq, except this time the people who opposed it are cheerleading George. I like to draw stick figures, W. Bush as a hero. At least that's what the mainstream alternative media, algorithmically pushed by Elon and other oligarchs, say. Now, as a side note, proving once again getting behind the woodshed at reallibertymedia.com is not listening to alternative media, but getting that dose of reality, and likely why we hear crickets behind the woodshed from all of it and them, mainstream alternative media. Coriella Isabel writes, those who gatekeep analysis and journalism as if it's only valuable if they are the same 10 people who go on the same 6 major YouTube shows and agree. I'm going to add now for this the ex-Twitter feeds, the Rumble type of syndication that Rumble itself, Wall Street Speak, presents to us. It's certainly not reallibertymedia.com. So I'm going to add all that under what she writes here. What am I saying? This, you ask? Well, it's evident that Donald J. Trump's presidency has been inorganically manufactured to convince everyone that he is the man to save America in the world from the globalist communist elites. The globalists are liberal and conservative capitalists, and two, Trump is a billionaire influenced by technocratic oligarchs and Zionists. Thus, his foreign policy is nothing but a deep state continuation of the next phase of U.S. empire, one that's increasingly dangerous for U.S. citizens and those in its downward path of wrath. But don't forget that I've been talking exactly about this well before Trump coming in and on through now, and it's picked up by Fiorella Isabel. She's talking in the very same tone relative to watching out and looking at what's going on, and that for my contribution, that downward path is into the stinking abyss. And remember here that I've mentioned the open-air prison of Gaza resembles the open-air prison we call America, though few see it that way, or the transparent occupation controlling it. And if you need to visualize the property destruction in the open-air demolition site in concentration camp called America, no, not bombs, but the kindler and gentler explosive economics that you see happen here, seek out the pictures of the Detroitification of the United States. She writes, the Abraham Accords, baby, the Abraham Shields plan, coming to a city near you. And I need to interject, this is a model, so maybe it's already has come to a city near you under a different name or promotion. But no one noticed. She writes, this is all happening because the most Zionist administration in the U.S. history is tasked with expanding the greater Israel via the Abraham Accords and includes Israel's new Abraham Shield plan, created by the Coalition of Regional Security, which was established a year after October 7th, and says the attack was part of a larger Iranian plan. The coalition supposedly represents a wide and diverse group of public figures and opinion leaders in the security, diplomacy, business, high-tech, and research fields who joined together to ensure the security of the State of Israel through a promotion of the Abraham Shield plan. The first goal of this entity is to close the front in Gaza and establish a technocratic transitional government in Gaza with regional backing that will provide all civilian services to Palestinians during the transition period. The eerily Gestapo-sounding, well-thought-out plan also claims Israel will declare victory in Gaza and the defeat of Hamas military forces. Israel's blockade plan against Iran will involve military, political, and economic actions aimed at isolating it from the region, including the Gulf, stopping its connection to the resistance, and dismantling its proxy networks. The plan also outlines Israel's reliance on U.S. partners to hinder Iran's reemergence in Syria, promoting a stable government, aka HTS, head choppers. As expected, this also details Turkey's role in shaping Syria's future via Israeli plans to establish communication channels to Ankara to, quote, advance mutual interest in regional stability, close quote. In its goals of expansion, Israel will prioritize establishing and normalizing arrangements with Saudi Arabia, initiating the Abraham Alliance, which will foster security, intelligence, and political cooperation among Israel, Egypt, Jordan, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Sudan, and other allies with U.S. support. I've got to pause. Have you been listening to what I've been reporting on coming through relative to Africa? And we've got some more coming. And what the United States is doing here as the geopolitical play goes on. We're going to go UFC fighting in America. We watch the plan being put on other people. That's being also put on right on us that we don't even recognize in the United States. The alliance aims to control Egypt and Jordan while combating the resistance forces. The alliance will be used as a special trade zone and global economic hub through agreements in various sectors of infrastructure projects connected to the Gulf, to the Mediterranean. We're clearly seeing how the betrayal of the Gulf Arab states to the resistance has become an essential tool for greater Israel. In essence, the Zionist entity outlines exactly what I and few others have been trying to warn about: the entire end of the Palestinian people without a state, and even under the semblance of such a government, a total apartheid, Gestapo existence, where all movements are controlled, all welfare based in Israel's mood, similar to what was before, only this time on steroids. This is BTWRLM 635. So let's expand now those few paragraphs I read from this extensive article. Let's expand the movements controlled on steroids model out a wee bit. Sounds like sustainable SMART 15-minute cities, don't it? Trump's and Obama's strong communities, and before those, tyrants Clinton's strong cities initiative, now on steroids. Is Trump's not-so-great America already constructed to make the Zionist Federation technocrat movement great again? Quote, total apartheid Gestapo existence is just the beginning. Right, Zionist and genocide apologist P.T. Barnum Muskrat? I mean, the world's population is already in collapse, but let's agree to genocide, murder, kill more Palestinians. Is that about right? It seems Musk's postings about unrecoverable world population reduction is a progress report. Fiorella goes on to write, Israel's raids will mean more death to Palestinians, but under a lawful excuse, while any defense by the resistance will once again be labeled terrorism. What lawful excuse, really? You hear that, you American homegrown? Your resistance to tyranny is terrorism. But who am I talking to in a nation of suicidal cricketism? This time, the ethnic cleansing will be legitimized by international law, governments, and rehashed as humanitarian advancement, as progress in the age of so-called multipolarity, as Palestine is turned into the land of Israel with Western exploits. The resistance faction, Yemen, and those actually clear-minded about what to do next to preserve faith and understanding, as not all is lost, Israel was weakened PR-wise and morally. The wars are not ending, but moving theaters and pivoting toward new regions. Time to wake up in the real sense and fight, because what's coming will need all to be fully ready. Yes, be fully ready, because the fight is already at home, and Trump is the fallen general for the they. Are you like the pom-pom thrusting Trump cheerleaders, thinking the steak tastes great? Or have you been preparing as you've been told behind the woodshed, because the Matrix is not a movie? There is no spoon. The fight is not physical in a spiritual war. And is that air you think you breathe? Because they are here, and Trump is now leading the technocrat so-called charge right into the Siberian gulag that they want. Pom-poms of the pom-pomeranians to the contrary notwithstanding. Right, Palantir, Oracle, Apple, Google, and all you humanists, to name just a few. You say tomato, I say tomato. You say Palestine, I say Trumpenstein. In evidence, the global techno-nutcases are on the move and prevailing as we see cash disappearing in China. I hope you all folks are tying all this together, because this is not different. It's not different nations. This is one plan coming together. It just looks like it's from a lot of different places. Mobile payments are dominant in the Asian country, while the traditional means of exchange have dwindled to near extinction, the outlet says. Coins and banknotes have nearly disappeared from everyday life in China. From supermarkets to cafes to public transportation, most payments are now made exclusively through mobile apps such as WeChat Pay and Alipay. The two platforms have become essential tools for daily living in the world's second largest economy. Their logos are displayed at virtually every checkout, and many businesses no longer use traditional cash registers. Instead, vendors scan a QR code on the customer's smartphone and complete the sale. I want to remind you, the people that go to food banks now, in some food banks, have a QR code or a UPC code that identifies the customer. Only the oldest shoppers still use coins and notes. You hear that? Only the oldest, likely the wisest and understanding the condition, they still use coins and notes, noting that across the rest of the China society, cash has virtually vanished. The shift is especially visible in urban markets, where even fruit and vegetable sellers rely on mobile payments. Most taxi drivers no longer accept cash, and many small neighborhood shops lack the ability to provide change, discouraging cash transactions altogether. The dominance of WeChat and Alipay has diminished the role of traditional banking service for many young Chinese who are often only engaged with banks for tasks like obtaining mortgages. In response, China's central bank has accelerated the development of digital currency, the digital yuan, aiming to maintain monetary control amid the rise of private payment platforms. Pilot programs began in several cities in 2019, with a smartphone app launching in 2022. Remember the great Kobe swindle right after that. Gearing up. Again, it's a plan. Despite claims of 260 million accounts open, the digital yuan remains largely absent from daily life, overshadowed by the convenience of existing apps. So the answer to this more perfectus monetary enslavement is to domesticate privatized to the government what circulates as money. In this case, the digital currency. The government has to own the use of it. And when they do that, they then can require its use, legalizing it. They regulate it. They tax it. And what did Russia just do? They owned the app, wholly displacing the private competitors. That app of the Russian government is now required to be on every phone after September to use the government's created digital ruble, as I read that Neustis on an episode or two ago. I also noted prior to that on a different episode that Russia also enacted a law on biometrics, provides for the voluntary submission of data. That refusal to provide services due to the absence of the biometrics is prohibited, and that there will be no biometric access control. But what does that matter when the app is already in the phone and identifying you? So this is the way we watch the legislation roll out. We get lulled into believing they're doing it for us, or they're looking out for us, but it's not. They just don't need it anymore. Cost them nothing to outlaw something they don't need. Now, for our purposes here, when the United States government federalizes, privatized to the government, the issuance of paper fiat currency in 1913, putting this country far ahead of both Russia and China by over 100 years in its quest to conquer we the people, into a debt slavery. In creating that privatized government scourge in fiat currency allowed that any use of this potential harmful, even criminal privilege could be taxed from any source derived. It's voluntarily taxed, they'll say. True. I'll explain that in a moment. So they make the currency, they get you to use it, legal tender, you adopt it, and now it's a harmful thing. In the fact that they tax it tells you it's a harmful thing. And we know that except for the fraud of omission, except when you go to the taxation and you see that's a civil right. It's mentioned that 42 U.S.C. 1981 is required to the government to mitigate the harm caused in using the fiat currency. Do you understand that? You didn't have to use the fiat. Using it is a harmful government privilege. But when you did voluntarily use that, you admitted to committing a criminal act, privileged as it was, but the government overseeing a free country and all, accommodates that voluntary use through various licenses, the evidence of the lawful application of regulation and obligation to voluntarily pay that tax, or else. The government created a harmful thing which people, legal entities, voluntarily use or exploit and speculate upon. That requiring the government to tax and regulate the use from all sources to mitigate the harm caused by the voluntary use of the criminal fiat currency the government created. So this is a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis condition that we've all fell into. Where else do we hear this synthesis but in the term solution? Property or rights diminishing, dispute resolution, collaborative problem-solving processes, public administrative hearings, unless otherwise prohibited by law or consent, where you are the problem, the obstruction to that agenda. Hegel D. much? See, this is sustainable, transparent control process is already global and long before the UN. It's pervasive and largely transparent to people in this successfully occupied nation. To wash, rinse, and repeat. Right, Lincoln? This government created crime controls the very similarly what governments do generally to regulate certain identifiable, exploitable trades, occupations, and professions, so-called, which are now government-approved then through license for a kinder, gentler plunder or harm. Generally, the licensees and their potential for harm, those activities that are done for profit that might be caused because of that focus, if you don't know to find an available carve-out around those, and I'll just maybe one word to give you, a livelihood, you'll see a bit of some of the carves out when you don't need licenses, when there's the right to do private contract, which is that can't be overrun, but those are very small. You really have to read close for those, and they bury those when you find them. I've had a couple of them. We used to do things for contractors, and the law didn't allow for them to regulate or license private contractors. And they hid that right in a rule so deep after we pointed it out that it became very hard to show people. So, at any rate, the livelihood is there if you know to avoid all the other entanglements. And the carve-outs usually appear to avoid providing criminal master-servant employment or slavery, or taking or giving it as well. When you notice that, stay away from being an employer. Why? It's a private contractor. You're not an employer. And due to the high potential of unlawful exploitation in the master-servant relationship, the government comes in to regulate, and then it's accepted based on the limited liability if you follow the rules, which apparently goes out the door when the potential for profiteering and scam nation through privateering walks in. And the scam nation, especially when the fiat is the monetary system itself. So back to money and talking the lead from the extortionate governments to avoid its felonious, extortionate, coercive controls. If it weren't a government with the consent of the governed, what do we the people need to do to privatize each our own monetary policy? To privatize the money of we the people, all we need to do is use gold and silver coin. Better yet, pass laws to mint precious metal coin in the states and require its lawful tender for all purposes. Then there's no tracking, tracing, or taxing, and other things. Free to move about the country. But convenience, you say? Because that's what the government's point. Oh, it's so convenient to go digital. Convenience? Well, how convenient is it going to be when the government app says no? Because we, the bureaucrats, AI enhanced and all, say you owe us our extortion. That until you comply, your request is denied. No, you can't. You are locked down. Yeah, not too convenient or free, is it? So additionally, in those sound money acts in the states, add the charge of treason levied against any encroachment upon the use by we the people, the red-blooded Americans, of our sound money. Why we the people have not insisted before now on this is really a wonder to me. And yes, it's an obscure type of concession, but we should have never walked away from it. It used to be part of us a long time back, in the day, the real in the day. Not in just past memory. Privatizing our money to be sound against the government is the answer to domesticated government fiat and the fast approaching token citizenship with its oh so convenient blockchained and enslaved. And what did I say about the humiliation last episode? Such a tyrant Trump is. He had no right to attack Iran in the first place. Trump suspends possible Iran sanctions relief. The U.S. president accused the Islamic Republic's supreme leader of ingratitude for claiming to have won the standoff with Israel. What an insult, right, folks? I mean, Iran's just going to have to say, be gone, you demon. We don't need your wicked ways. Get thee behind me, great Satan. From bunker buster to Nobel dreams, Trump's war for peace. Choosing a military solution over a negotiated one in the dealing with Iran is a throwback to U.S. unilateralism and regime change policies. And I'm bringing these things through to show you the incongruities with this guy Trump. And it's really not just him. He's just the face of a stinking underbelly of what's been going on and going to go on and being transformed right before everybody's eyes. Well, we think great things are going on. But they denied being about regime change. Why, I thought this report was important. Trump tried to make it look like this is a all parties in type discussion. When you notice, no parties are in. Trump just makes these decisions. And then it's up to the country, like in this case Iran, to decide strategically how are they going to respond. The U.S. seems to have learned no lessons from the post-Cold War phase of its unilateralism and regime change policies in the Middle East. Instead of a new peaceful and stable order being established under Washington's tutelage, it ended in a collapse of countries, not merely regimes, chaos, civil war, and the rise of Islamic extremism and terrorism. It is not clear that legitimate U.S. core interests were served by its military interventions to reorder the political forces in the region. If the objective was also to remove the regimes that were a threat to Israel's security and erode Russian influence in the region, some success may have been achieved in Iraq and Syria, though in a divided Libya, Moscow seems to have gained ground, giving Israel a freer hand in Lebanon and Syria and virtual carte blanche in Gaza and in the West Bank, too, may have in short term given it an upper hand in security terms, but longer term, the issue, the answer to Israel's security dilemmas may not lie in asserting its regional hegemony with the backing of the United States. A ceasefire between Israel and Iran, even if it holds, is a simple pause. The underlying issues remain unresolved. Let me interject here. Remember, that's what I said the last few episodes. Trump's not making peace. You're not making peace and ceasefire. And we wondered, at least I wondered, I hope my listener wonders, that it's not even a ceasefire. It may be only a truce, and then it's not even that. And so we're not even sure, actually, under international norms, what they're doing. It's just words, and it just shows a lack of concerted intent to peace. Again, strategic ambiguity is not how we want to hear things if we are going to work toward a peaceful settlement going forward. Iran needs to give up its rhetoric that Israel has no right to exist it is most unlikely that Iran will give up its nuclear program and its rights under the NPT. Iran has decided to end the monitoring of its program by the IEA. Iran has accused the agency heading and leaking information about its nuclear scientists to the U.S. and Israelis and facilitating their assassination. Meanwhile, the whereabouts of Iran's highly enriched uranium are not known. There are also some doubts about the extent of the damage caused to the Iranian nuclear sites by the U.S. bombers. Therefore, the assessment is that Iran's program could be revived quickly enough. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has questioned the integrity of IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi for pressuring Iran to allow renewed access to its nuclear facilities. Peace Prize Path. That Trump has chosen a military solution over a negotiated one is a throwback to the U.S. unilateralism and regime change policies. The U.S. attack on Iran is a gross violation of international law. It infringes the U.N. Charter. The U.S. had no mandate from the U.N. Security Council to act against Iran. There are no provisions of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that would allow the recognized nuclear powers to eliminate a suspected nuclear program of a non-nuclear state in a violation of the treaty. The U.S. attack also cannot be justified as a preemptive one, as Iran is not threatening to attack the United States. The rhetoric of the rule-based international order has been exposed for what it is. The irony is that Trump's election rhetoric was against the U.S. getting involved in wars abroad, which he believed had drained America's resources, and his MAGA base wanted the U.S. to focus on domestic priorities. Pakistan tried to capitalize on Trump's obsession for the Nobel Prize by officially nominating him for one after his unprecedented invitation to a foreign military chief, Pakistan's field marshal, to lunch with him at the White House. This sycophantic ploy recoiled on Pakistan when virtually the next day Trump attacked Iran militarily. Trump believes that now summoning Israel and Iran to a ceasefire shows his commitment to peace. Unsurprisingly, his supporters in the U.S. Congress have nominated him for a Nobel Prize. And where did all that bombing get Israel and the U.S.? Just as I predicted, behind the woodshed. Iran bans Grossi from nuclear sites, sniffs IAE cameras after sensitive info leaked to Israel. Heck, it's a spy, folks. There's no trust, there's no confidence in any of this going on. This is not, cannot be peaceful. And there's no intention or any type of action being taken to make it look like it is intended to be peaceful by any of the parties that are attacking. Tensions between the UN nuclear watchdog and Iran are at an all-time high amid Tehran's allegations of agency's complicity in Israel and U.S. aggression. Quote, we will no longer give Grossi permission to be present at nuclear sites or install cameras because we saw information about our sites and documents obtained from the Israeli regime, Iranian Parliamentary Vice Speaker Hamid Reza Rahaji Babeahi announced Saturday. The high-ranking official's comments follow an ex-post from Foreign Minister Aragachi Friday saying Grossi's insistence on visiting the sites bombed by U.S. and Israel, quote, under the pretext of safeguard, is meaningless and possibly even malign intent. Iran's parliament voted to halt collaboration with the International Atomic Energy Agency this week until such a time that the safety and security of the country's nuclear activities can be assured. Again, 1 week after I suggested and said what the treaty was about, they are confirming that's exactly what this was about, and they were not protected in the least. And after what the parliament did, Iranian parliament did, Iran followed through. Iran bars IAE Chief Grossi through nuclear facility inspections. From nuclear facility inspections, Tehran announces end of cooperation with the IAEA, citing leaked facility data in Israeli documents. So consistently, we're seeing the continuation of this going on. I told you it would become the ability for Iran to pull out completely, and now the West will be sitting there wondering what's going on. And so they've actually acted. And this is, again, more evidence that the B-2 and Tomahawk didn't eliminate or obliterate a nuclear program they deny the IAE access to. If we're looking at whether we want to trust Trump and what they were saying, or Hegseth and all these other folks. If it doesn't exist, if it's obliterated, you don't deny someone access to something that's gone. So let's recap all this real quickly. I'm getting from Joaquin Flores, just found it, just looking for things on this topic. Hoax. Iran says U.S. claims of destroying nuclear facilities like Fardo are lies. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said that the claims of facilities destroyed like the nuclear center of Fardo are false. No radiation leaks, period. This was later confirmed by IAEA, and I say this, and I'm reading this, and I'm reminded of my own statements weeks and weeks ago, relative to this, saying the very same thing at the time. Officials in the region said that the minor damage and rejected Trump's claim that Fardo was destroyed. Iranian MP Raisi said that the main strikes hit ground structures and that all potentially dangerous materials had been removed in advance. We're going to have another story here real quick relative to this moving and what I said before was going on. It was all in the news. I don't have any special intelligence to figure this out. I'm talking about on the ground, boots on the ground, anybody I talk to. I don't talk with anybody. Just look through the news, filter it through, figure out what's going on. And came up with all the same information. Tasman says the night of the Fardo area was calm. Local residents heard air defenses and drones, but no powerful explosions. The smoke in the footage showed the IRNA was recorded outside the complex. Residents of Qom called the U.S. statements bluff and stressed the Iranian nuclear facilities remain intact. So now we move to here, backing all that up, and we see more evidence of the three-ring greatest show kabuki theater on Earth, right out of the Manhattan Mahler's mouth. Trump says he told Iran to go ahead when they said that they had to take a shot at U.S. base in retaliation. The POTUS said while speaking to supporters at the rally in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, they called me to tell me that they have to take a shot at us. This was Iran, very respectfully. That means they respect us. Because we dropped 14 bombs, they said, we'd like to take 14 shots at you. I said, go ahead, I understand. Trump continued. They said, where they wanted to do it, and I said, good. We emptied out the fort. It was a beautiful military base in Qatar, who treated us really fantastically well, and they said, sir, 1 o'clock okay? I said, it was fine. We could make it later. We had nobody but four gunners. We had four. They call them gunners. They shoot the Patriots. They shoot the missiles up. It's hard to believe. So, out of his Manhattan Mahler's own mouth, my synthesis from the developing information at the time, after the unwarranted attack by Israel and the United States, with B-2 bombers and the mother of all ineffectual bombs for the task, the MOABs, and the Tomahawk missiles, we are told. I said, showed that it was likely not, as we were said, it wasn't as dire as they were telling us. It was promoted as the beginning of World War III, or what I deemed WWE, after sifting the nuggets from the Neustis, was correct here. A global extravaganza and clown show to make P.T. Barnum proud. To his credit, though, at least Trump admitted to it. So there will be no excuses for any belief these matters are other than the public consumption I mentioned that they should be. It looked like they were going to be last episode, because it seems people love to be lied to or readily suspend their disbelief of reality if it makes them feel good, which will never make America great again, and in particular, as long as it remains divided, as we see it does and is planned to be. And I'm not sure I see a way to mend it up on the core issues that we need as we the people. And as I suspected, the U.S. did not use bunker buster bombs on one of the Iran's nuclear sites, top general tells lawmakers, citing depth of the target. The U.S. military did not use bunker buster bombs at one of Iran's largest nuclear sites last weekend because the site is so deep that the bombs likely would not have been effective. The comment by Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Dan Kane, Enable, which was described by the three people who heard his remarks and a fourth who was briefed on them, is the first known explanation given for why the U.S. military did not use the massive ordnance penetrator bomb, the MOPS, the MOAB, against the Isfahan site in central Iran. Now, this is starting to touch more what I said last episode as well. If you're dropping bombs, why are you dropping any bombs at all when you know that they were too far down? But they said they did, and so I'm saying maybe not. U.S. B-2 bombers dropped over a dozen bunker buster bombs on Iran's Fardo and Natanz nuclear sites, but Isfahan was only struck by Tomahawk missiles launched from a U.S. submarine. So notice when you see in this article, the statement is not a quote. It's just a bare statement. Nobody is further commenting about either. The classified briefing to lawmakers was conducted by Kane. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. A spokesperson for Kane declined to comment, noting that he cannot comment on a chairman's classified briefings to Congress. Democrat Senator Chris Murphy told CNN on Thursday night after receiving the briefing that some of Iran's capabilities are so far underground that we can never reach them. So they have the ability to move a lot of what has been saved into areas where there's no American bombing capacity that can reach it, telling us and admitting that U.S. did not use MOABs on one site does not affirmatively say the U.S. used MOABs at all. They knew it was too far down. What else did the U.S. not drop on what can't be determined? And where it was known the U.S. wouldn't drop MOABs on the site due to ineffectiveness. That they are, quote, are so far underground that we can never reach them. And that there's no American bombing capacity that can reach it. Who made the decision to drop any MOABs on the other sites that they knew wouldn't be effective because they were beyond any American bombing capacity? Not one. Not 14 would work. Nor did they. Where's the proof any MOABs were dropped? They're like $20 million a piece, these bombs. And then all the aircraft that was taken to make this work. And we're talking about Trump saying, oh, they called us. We were in contention. We were told. We told them all. Everyone was in understanding. We moved. Everybody moved their stuff away. And if they were used and failed, 14 no less. Shouldn't some people have their very tail kicked into the street, losing their positions of lucrative, fraudulent military-industrial contracts for fraud, waste, and abuse? That what was promised to be delivered, the destructive punch, couldn't 14 tries later, is really an embarrassment. And now we might see why the catbox cover-up of the embarrassment begins in this article under the cover of the secrecy and national security, because never let them see you sweat. Quote, there is an enriched uranium in the facilities that moves around, but that was not the intent of our mission, Republican Representative Michael McCaul of Texas told CNN. Quote, my understanding is most of it's still there. So we need a full accounting. That's why Iran has to come to the table directly with us so the International Atomic Energy Agency can account for every ounce of enriched uranium that's there. Now, he said that after attacking Iran without warrant, and then they asked for favors. Besides, I think they just told the IAEA to go pound sand in Iran, go pound sand IAEA for its duplicity, aiding the U.S. and Israel in their attacks against them. Is the stupidity in this administration. I don't think it's going out of the country. I think it's all at the facilities, is what he concludes. Now, let me inform you on something, Michael. Your opinion means nothing. It's not worth the powder to blow up a firecracker with. You are overseeing and condoning the commission of egregious crimes. Quote, the purpose of the mission was to eliminate certain particular aspects of their nuclear program. Those were eliminated. To get rid of the nuclear material was not part of the mission. GOP Republican Greg Murphy told CNN. Any and all of which was unlawful. And they're negating to look at that directly. These are law writers. These are the legislative branch. Supposed to know a law and how to enforce it and how it's enforced and how it's done when you write the law, don't you think? Well, apparently not. We're going to look right past all the violations of the law, and we're going to focus on something that we're never going to find. And despite the fact that 14 bunker buster bombs at $20 million apiece did nothing to eliminate non-existent nuclear weapons or to stop Iran's intention to continue its nuclear program for peaceful purposes, a new bill may let Trump give Israel B-2 bombers and bunker buster bombs. Leave it to the government. A new bill proposed by a pair of bipartisan lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives would provide President Donald Trump with authorization to give Israel B-2 stealth bombers and GBU-57 bunker buster bombs if Iran continues to develop a nuclear weapon following the U.S. military strikes on Iran's three main nuclear facilities. And we just heard there's no evidence that they're doing a weapon. And these people are representing the people of the United States? Bipartisan? Unipartisan? Mike Lawler, Lawless, seems to me, and Josh Gottheimer have proposed the Bunker Buster Act to give the president the ability to take action to ensure Israel is prepared for all contingencies if Iran seeks to develop a nuclear weapon. Well, they just attacked him when they weren't. And how's one B-2 bomber going to work this when the 14 and a whole 125 aircraft didn't and a submarine full of Tomahawks? Quote, Iran, the leading state sponsor, you understand what's going on here. They're positioning heavy-duty advanced weaponry into Israel, the aircraft carrier of the United States. Iran, the leading state sponsor of terror, is what they say here. Sounds like Israel to me. Sounds like the United States to me. One of America's top enemies can never have a nuclear weapon, Gottheimer said in the statement. That's why I strongly supported our military action earlier this month. Iran has killed scores of Americans, including our service members, and repeatedly attacked our key democratic ally, Israel. Israel must be able to defend herself against Iran and ensure that Iran cannot rebuild its nuclear capabilities. That statement is completely against international law. Israel has no right to defend itself as an illegal belligerent occupier. And Iran didn't attack Israel. Israel attacked Iran for no valid reason and killed more than scores of Iranians, as well as hundreds of thousands of innocent Palestinians. Where's the concern for those people when the concern seemed to be to kill more innocent people? So we're just going to give them more power to kill innocent people, I suppose. That's the answer of the United States government. U.S. B-2 bomber pilots launched a 14 GBU 57 bunker buster bombs against Iran's major nuclear facilities last month. Trump previously claimed that the results of the military strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities were total obliteration and suggested that Iran's nuclear program was set back by decades. But nothing that can't be quickly replaced, that was the damage that we were heard, because whatever the facilities are so deep in the ground that there are no bunker busters that can reach it, and they're useless, despite being very expensive. While Israel is conducting numerous strikes against Iran and eliminated a significant number of the Middle East nation's military leaders and military infrastructure, the U.S. ally does not currently have a GBU-57 massive ordnance penetrators, which are 30,000-pound bunker buster bombs that were developed by the United States Air Force to destroy Iran's capability of producing a nuclear weapon. But they didn't destroy Iran's capability, let alone they have stated they have no intention, Iran has stated, they have no intention of develop any nuclear weapons, and none have been found. How long has this plan been going on against Iran this way? Well, so let's just give Israel some bunker busters. And you know, those B-2s don't fly by themselves, as I said. They have to run a number of those B-2s in order to cover for the B-2s that they're using. Just like they did, they had to run a pack of them over the Pacific to make it believe like they weren't doing any attacks in Iran, and they also sent the attacking, at least we're told, the attacking forces in. So you can't just say you're going to give them one B-2 on this. That doesn't work. It's ineffective on top of it all. This is what's weird about this whole story. While the United States has 19 operational B-2 stealth bombers, as of last year, the United States does not provide any of its allies with stealth bombers. In a statement obtained by the outlet, Lawless said, "This bill gives the president the authority to equip Israel with the tools of training they need to deter Tehran and make a world a safer place." Is that true? Will the peacemaker-enabling genocidal psychopaths bombing innocent people make the world a safer place? And why does the United States blindly, stupidly, blasphemously support Israel? It's because of that not-so-right woke identity politics through hyphenated religiosity. I touched on this problem a number of episodes back, studying Secretary of the State of War Department, as Trump wants to now call it, the War Department. I wonder if all these people covertly listen behind which head, because I routinely touch that official Defense Department euphemism. But regarding this Hegseth identification politics, being a Judeo-Christian, an oxymoron at best, you know, the I believe therefore I am group of the confused, these woke are part of the so-called Judeo-Christian cult, deceivers of a nation and multitude near you. What we see adulterating the U.S. government. Remember, thou shalt not commit adultery. Another look at this in a warning written by Dr. Matthew Ma'avat. Sacrilege and statecraft. How Christian Zionism distorts scripture to serve empire. Why America's blessed Israel obsession risks the church, the world, and the truth. During a recent interview with Tucker Carlson, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz displayed not only alarming geopolitical ignorance, but also a brazen willingness to distort scripture in defense of his unwavering support for Israel. Well, alarming wasn't quite far enough when I heard that interview segment. Shockingly immense void in such a small space between the ears of Ted Cruz that pretends to have some wisdom and awareness and intelligence and applicable knowledge greater than a box of rocks. And I'm not trying to insult the combined wisdom, awareness, and intelligence and applicable knowledge of a box of rocks or even one rock in that box. You folks in the don't mess with Texas, you really vote for this guy? I mean, really? That's the best you got? Really? I mean, really, really? I thought P.T. Barnum Muskrat said woke identity politics is dead. But then he moved to Texas, didn't he? The wisdom, awareness, intelligence, and applicable knowledge of a box of rocks is looking pretty good right now. Shocking. Nikola Tesla's coil would be embarrassed. The verse he quoted, Genesis 12:3, was shamelessly truncated, a common tactic used to lend divine legitimacy to Zionist exceptionalism in end times prophecy. This verse has become the theological bedrock of a militant worldview known as Christian Zionism. Even Jewish critics of Israel's state policy expressed dismay at the historical illiteracy and theological crudeness fueling this metastasizing ideology within American evangelical circles. I recall debating this phenomenon over a decade ago in Lincoln with Jewish and Israeli interlocutors. I had dubbed it a trailer trash cult, a fusion of biblical illiteracy, apocalyptic fervor, and geopolitical delusion. Some of my Israeli counterparts, in a strange display of casual prejudice, alternately referred to Cruz and present Secretary of State Marco Rubio simply as the Mexican. Christian Zionism thrives on biblical illiteracy and selective scriptural appropriation. May I interject that that's what I found when I read to you the analysis of what this ideology does. He comes to the same conclusion as I found in my analysis, months and months ago. Though often presented as an ancient and immutable, it is, in fact, a relatively modern phenomenon emerging alongside the rise of political Zionism in the late 19th century. Rather than treating scripture as sacrosanct, it distorts the biblical canon into a pliable tool, one that must conform to the ideological imperatives of the moment in a nation such as the United States, which has been at war nearly 95% of its existence. This distortion often serves as a theological cover for an endless war doctrine, with cherry-picked verses used to sanctify geopolitical aggression and the confection of new enemies. After World War II, when the Soviet Union became the first nation to grant de jure recognition to the modern state of Israel, this same movement began fervently mining scripture to cast the USSR and the Russia in particular as the apocalyptic villains Gog and Magog. Even Ronald Reagan, the pseudo-religious saint of American conservatism, repeatedly invoked this interpretive heresy to frame the Cold War as a cosmic battle against the evil empire. To this day, millions of American evangelicals and fundamentalist Protestants, as Protestants worldwide, continue to see Russia as an eternal enemy of God himself. The reach and influence of this pseudo-theological subculture should not be underestimated. But before unpacking the wider ramifications of this ideological perversion, let us first examine the verse Senator Cruz so conveniently misquoted, Blessings and Curses of Genesis. Senator Cruz invoked Genesis 12:3 to justify unwavering U.S. support for Israel, but his citation was conspicuously selective. The full verse reads, quote, And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families on the earth be blessed. This is a prophetic promise given to the patriarch Abraham, pointing ultimately to his seed, Jesus Christ. It is through Christ, according to Galatians 3:16, that all families on the earth are offered reconciliation with the divine. If that blessing is universal and messianic in scope, where then is the ethnic or national exclusivity so often ascribed to modern-day Israel? I've explored these topics in greater depth here and here and here. When you get the article, you get the links, you can read more in-depth of what this author's writing is about. But Cruz's theological framework, in practice, aligns more closely with the Talmudic ethnocentrism than Christian soteriology. Consider the remarkable claim from Rabbi Chaim Richman, directed at Christians. Quote, you guys are worshiping one Jew. That's a mistake. You should be worshiping every single one of us because we all die for your sins every single day. The Jewish people in the land of Israel are the bulwark against the orcs, okay? The orcs are coming not to a theater near you, but to your home. Aside from the Tolkien reference, which to my knowledge appears nowhere in the Talmud, Richmond quotes reveal the ideological terrain Cruz is orbiting. One more collective Jewish identity is quasi-divination, and adversaries are dehumanized as fantasy monsters. One suspects that the orcs are the sweeping euphemism for Arabs in the region, many of whom are surreptitious allies of Israel. The other recalcitrant orcs apparently are the Palestinians, whose refusal to accept their divinely appointed overlords remains an intractable problem. Ironically, Persians, the Iranians, have traditionally enjoyed a far more favorable depiction in Jewish scripture. From Cyrus the Great to Ahasuerus in the Book of Esther, modern geopolitical enmity is therefore a historical aberration, not a theological necessity. But if one follows Richmond's grotesque logic, does this unqualified worship of every single Jew extend even to those recently implicated in satanic child abuse scandals in Israel? At what point does solidarity become sacrilege, and does support for Israel require a total theological surrender? Signs, omens, and periodic delusion. There is a reason I describe Christian Zionism as a theological bankrupt subculture masquerading as prophecy. It is an ideology that sanctifies any war crime, any act of brutality by Israel forces because, according to its adherents, personal blessing from God is contingent on political allegiance to a modern nation state. When not actively mangling scripture, history, and basic morality, this movement manufactures signs of wonders out of thin air. The natural phenomenon, especially periodolic patterns, are routinely interpreted as divine communications. This is not harmless euphemism. It reflects a credulous mindset conditioned by groupthink, emotional-driven worship, and manipulative rhetoric. Hypnotic music, staged testimony, and carefully orchestrated atmosphere often whip congregants into frenzy of expectation where gullibility becomes spiritual virtue. I once watched a video of a Christian pilgrims in a van in Jerusalem who erupted in awe as beams of dappled sunlight flickered through roadside trees. To them, these fleeting light patterns were not a trick of motion and shadow, but angelic manifestations. They are, in fact, a common optical effect caused by light passing through foliage while in motion. Today, in a large swath of evangelicals are willing to interpret any mundane occurrence as divine endorsement of Israel's central role in the end times prophecy. But if they are seeking signs, they might consider one that cuts in the opposite direction. Right after Israel launched an unprovoked strike on Iran, a raven appeared to pull down an Israeli flag amid the rubble in an Israeli neighborhood. In Jewish Midrash, the raven is considered an omen. In the biblical narrative, it is the creature God used to sustain the prophet Elijah when he was near despair, 1 Kings 17. The raven is a creature associated with both judgment and provision. What message, then, was it delivering? Now imagine if the bird had torn down a Palestinian or Iranian flag. The Christian Zionist ecosystem would have erupted in mass ecstasy. Social media feeds would overflow with headlines declaring it a sign from heaven. Prophecy blogs would rush to decode its symbolism. Televangelists would loop the footage between pleas for donations. But since it's challenging their narrative, the event went studiously ignored, such as the schizoid reflex of Christian Zionist theology. Divine signs are valid only when they reinforce the script. Anything else, however biblical, however stark, is dismissed as a coincidence or satanic interference, blessings and curses. The reality check. There's an oft-cited quote attributed to Joseph Goebbels, though likely first used by Adolf Hitler, that says, "A lie repeated 1,000 times becomes truth." Christian Zionists have chanted Genesis 12:3 so frequently and with such zeal that few within their ranks ever pause to test the verse against either scripture or empirical reality. Let's do that now. Genesis 1:3 says, "I will bless those who bless you and curse you, him who curses you." If we are to interpret this as a blanket mandate for state-level foreign policy, the evidence should be obvious. So ask yourself, are Israel's most loyal allies today, particularly in the West, truly blessed? Take the United States. It is arguably more internally divided than any point since the Civil War. Its cities are decaying. Homelessness and drug addiction are rampant. Race relations are at its lowest ebb, and nearly 40% of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency expense without borrowing, selling their family heirloom, or falling into debt. And yet billions in unconditional aid continue to flow to Israel year after year. Western Europe fares no better. The continent faces deepening political polarization and crisis of institutional legitimacy and escalating cultural clashes fueled by migration and economic inequality. What's passed for democratic consensus is now fractured by populism, apathy, and unrest. Social cohesion is unraveling across transatlantic alliance. Now compare the East Asia and Southeast Asia, where most countries maintain measured, neutral stances on Israeli-Palestine conflict. With a combined population of 2.4 billion, these region encompasses countless ethnicities and religions, yet remain strikingly more stable. Aside from Myanmar, whose military junta has been supplied with Israeli weaponry, there are no continent-wide wars, nor the sort of existential society fracturing plaguing the West. Immigration is limited to social harmony remains comparatively intact, and all major Asian nations support a two-state solution based on pre-1967 borders. No nation sucks up to Israel in this part of the world. So the question practically asks itself, if Genesis 12:3 is being used to evaluate foreign policy toward Israel, then who exactly is being blessed and who is being cursed? The consequence of the blind allegiance don't stop with economic decline. Consider the proxy war fed by Israeli strategic calculations. In Syria, Israeli support for jihadist factions have contributed to decimation of ethnic and religious minorities. Just this past Sunday, a suicide bomber detonated inside St. Elias Antiochian Orthodox Church, killing at least 15 Christian worshippers. These are not isolated tragedies. These are the fruits of Christian Zionism, a theology conflating real politics with divine mandate, endangering Christians worldwide. Why is it essential to confront the correctness narrative? Because the religious ideology peddled by Senator Cruz and his ilk bears no resemblance to authentic Christianity. It is a dangerous theological counterfeit, a den of wolves in sheep's clothing, precisely as Matthew 7:15 warned. From defending the faith, Christians, Zionism actively endangers Christians across the globe. In its zeal to uphold Pax Americana, idolize the modern state of Israel, and force current events into contrived apocalyptic scripts, it sacrifices actual Christian communities on the altars of geopolitics and eschatological fantasy. As someone descended from one of the oldest Christian traditions, whose roots reach back even to the Old Testament, I say plainly, have no fellowship with these murderous idolaters. They invoke Christ, but serve the ambitions of the empire, the delusions of man, and the devices of Satan. If that is what it means to be blessed, then your church should beware of what it really is worshiping. This has been BTW RLM 635. I'll be with you next week. Tech Diffs, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close. Lessons to learn, dose by dose. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.